You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we check in on how Republicans and Democrats are working together on some national issues and whether or not we're seeing some renewed bipartisanship in Congress. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected part of Wisconsin's redistricting plan yesterday. That plan was drafted by Governor Tony Evers and approved by the Wisconsin Supreme Court earlier this month. But in an unsigned order yesterday, a majority of justices sent the maps back to the state Supreme Court, leaving Wisconsin with no legislative maps weeks before candidates are set to start running in the state's new districts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court? Do you want to see the state go with these maps from Governor Evers, so state Republicans, a different set of maps altogether? What questions do you have about how this works, what it means? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, here we are redistricting again. Sean, another in a long series of twists and turns here. Two decisions technically from the court. One yes, one no. Sort those out for us, first of all, please.
Yeah, so the decision on the congressional redistricting plan was the simplest one to explain because there were two appeals filed before the U.S. Supreme Court, one on the legislative redistricting plan, one on the congressional. And the court just basically told Republicans who filed the appeal in the congressional case, no, we're not going to hear this case. We're not going to issue a stay to block the state Supreme Court's map. And I mean, there was no explanation of the order. They just denied it, which is pretty common with the U.S. Supreme Court. So that is not officially done. But when the U.S. Supreme Court tells you we're not going to hear your appeal, Republicans appealing that map are kind of running out of options. The other decision, though, is that the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the legislative redistricting plan that was approved by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, that was drawn by Governor Tony Evers under, you know, a framework that the state Supreme Court established, this least changes framework. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that Evers and the state Supreme Court made a mistake in the way that they applied the Federal Voting Rights Act here. They didn't follow precedent in applying the Voting Rights Act to justify the drawing of seven a majority black assembly districts in Milwaukee. So there are a lot of ways the case could go from there, but the court sent it back to the state Supreme Court right now. And so at this point, we are waiting to see what the state Supreme Court is going to do, how it's going to proceed with just a few weeks to go before people are circulating nominating petitions.
Yeah, we'll look at some of those options in a bit. I want to get into why this ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Just a quick version. The legislature, Republican-led legislature, passed their maps. The governor vetoed them, so it's going to go to courts. And Sean, correct me if I'm wrong, there were cases brought to the state Supreme Court by Republicans saying this should be decided in the state Supreme Court. And then you mentioned the least changes thing. That was another case brought to the state Supreme Court. So that set the stage. That's why it came to the state Supreme Court first, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple paths that it could go down. And once the state Supreme Court said, yes, we will handle redistricting here, a federal court case that was going basically paused to wait for the state case to move forward. Then November, the state Supreme Court said, we are going to take a least changes approach to redistricting. So they didn't have to do that, but that is the path that they chose. And what that meant was whatever map that the state Supreme Court adopted was going to be very similar to the map that the legislature passed and former Governor Scott Walker signed in 2011. In other words, it's going to have a Republican lean. It's just a matter of how much. And so that took us to this year and what range of options the state Supreme Court might choose. The state Supreme Court chose the map drawn by Governor Tony Evers. So not a Democratic map, but not the most Republican map by any stretch of the imagination. And then Republican lawmakers immediately appealed that decision and made an argument that, kind of stuck with the U.S. Supreme Court. arguing basically that the state Supreme Court got it wrong in the way that it applied the Federal Voting Rights Act here. So it's not to say that the U.S. Supreme Court declared there was a Federal Voting Rights Act violation mm-hmm. in this map, just that the way that the state court got to its decision, the way that it showed its work, basically, is what one expert told me. It wasn't enough to satisfy Supreme Court precedent here. So the state Supreme Court got to go back to the drawing board.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at the latest on Wisconsin's election maps. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected the maps that apply to our state legislature, the Assembly and the Senate. And now, question mark, you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. How should we draw these maps here in Wisconsin? Do we need to change it? Do you like the system as it is? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay, Sean, U.S. Supreme Court says Wisconsin Supreme Court, at least show your work. What are the options? What could they do now?
So they're already getting suggestions, very helpful suggestions by the governor, by the legislature. Actually, you know, it is the other case, but those Republican members of Congress also filed something with the state Supreme Court and said, hey, why don't you reconsider the decision from earlier? Let's start that over. But we'll stay focused on the legislative stuff right now. The governor is saying, state Supreme Court, let's fully brief this matter and, you know, we can file everything by April 1st. That'll give you time to make a decision on, you know, which maps can go forward. And Evers is basically saying you can still work from my plan as the foundation of whatever you decide. That if you wanted to come up with a briefing that will satisfy the Voting Rights Act requirements that were laid out by the U.S. Supreme Court, we can do that. We can argue this in court, or we can brief it. You can issue your decision based on that. We can go there. Evers is also saying, if you don't want to do that, you know, we could also just adjust the Milwaukee part of the map, because that's where this Voting Rights Act dispute is centered. It's on these Milwaukee districts. Evers is saying, you know, one thing we could do is instead of having seven black majority districts in Milwaukee, we could maybe do six districts if the court wanted to go that way. You know, throwing out these options that will essentially preserve most of the map that Evers drew, that the state Supreme Court adopted in early March, but that will basically kind of get this thing moved on and be done with it. The legislature is taking a far different approach. They're saying, hey, let's just go with our map. I mean, they're saying that the governor's map lost in the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's not try to recover it. Let's just go with the one that passed the legislature. Mind you, this is the map that passed the legislature last year and was vetoed by the governor. So it's not like that has unanimous support.
Now, this is an election year, Sean, and the clock's ticking. I read some reports online of local clerks kind of hanging their heads because they just finished drawing their ward maps. Now maybe have to draw them again. What's the timeline here?
Well, I mean, we've already blown past the timeline that the Wisconsin Elections Commission initially told the court. They said that they wanted to have maps in place by March 1st so that they could get ready for circulating nominating petitions. Then when this was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Elections Commission said, okay, March 15th. March 15th is when we would like a decision. Blew past that deadline. Now we're at the point of, I don't know what the real deadline is, but I do know that on April 15th, candidates are scheduled to begin circulating nominating petitions. So, you know, the less time that the Elections Commission has to get prepared for that date, presumably the more difficult it will be, because that is kind of the hard deadline. And, you know, that is something that the courts have considered, particularly the U.S. Supreme Court has considered in the past when it comes to making changes related to an election. They have, at least since 2006, tried to shy away from that under this idea called the Purcell Principle, where you don't want to make disruptive mm-hmm. changes close to an election. In this case, though, they, you know, made a 7-2 ruling where, you know, on this Federal Voting Rights Act challenge, they said this is something you have to fix.
We're talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, with us today to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to throw out a redistricting plan from Governor Evers for the state legislature that was approved by the state Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this decision? Do you like our system of drawing maps in Wisconsin? What do you think of that least change idea, basically building the current maps based on the same ones that were passed just over 10 years ago? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about Wisconsin's election maps after a plan from Governor Evers was partially rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday and sent back to the state Supreme Court. The map of congressional districts still stands, but the state assembly and state senate districts, we don't know what's going to happen there. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sean Johnson stays with us, our Capital Bureau Chief here at WPR. Let's bring out a caller now. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I would just like nonpartisan people to do the redistricting in general. So I think if somehow this resulted in that for the state legislature, it'd be a great thing. If that doesn't happen, I probably would stick with the governor's map since that's the least bad. And I think he has the option of saying, look, this is okay. Let me just explain why, to sum it up. But I'm partly curious if this is basically the U.S. Supreme Court almost legislating from the bench, because we haven't had in Wisconsin, I believe, a lot of trouble before the maps are even in place with violating basically minority rights. And in this situation, I don't think we were. If anything, minority districts went up. So that's like saying there were, too many?
Nate, thanks for the call. And Nate's getting into the heart of the Supreme Court objection here related to the Voting Rights Act, Sean. This part of the Voting Rights Act was mainly intended for places in the Deep South, the former Confederacy, where lines were drawn to help make sure no black people ended up in legislatures, state or federal. Now the question is it too many districts with majority black populations when you go up from, 6 to 7?
Yeah, there's 6 majority black assembly districts on the map right now, and the governor's map would add another, so you'd have 7. And so the issue here is that the Supreme Court has said that under the Equal Protection Clause, you can't draw districts based solely on race, unless there's, for lack of a better term, like a really good reason. And so that really good reason can be satisfied by showing the court, look, under the Federal Voting Rights Act, we do need to make sure that we have majority black districts drawn to give black voters the chance to elect their candidate of choice. And so, drawing 7 when you haven't shown the need under this test that the Supreme Court has developed over the years is where the violation, if there was one, Republicans are saying could occur, that you have to go through this process to show that there is a need to draw these additional districts. Otherwise, if you're drawing a district based solely on race, then that could violate the U.S. Constitution. It gets really technical and complicated in a hurry. And this is the way that a lot of redistricting cases end up too. And we did have a very prominent national redistricting case in Wisconsin that was easy to understand a few years ago, where they were challenging this idea of whether a map can be too partisan. And, the Supreme Court ultimately said in another case, we're not going to get involved in that kind of stuff. But before that, Wisconsin's 2012 remap was challenged, and it ultimately boiled down to a Voting Rights Act challenge where a federal court changed a couple districts in Milwaukee That's how these things often end up. And it looks like how this one is ending up this time around, too.
Thanks for the call, Nate, at 800-642-1234. Kyle joins us now in DeForest. Kyle, hi.
Hi. I think it's just ridiculous that we're even having this argument. There's not anything in the world that I can think of, not sports, not gambling, well, except at casinos, that you can stack the deck in your favor. And it's fair. It's not cheating because, you know, if we stack the deck in sports in our favor, it's cheating. It's just indefensible that cheating, political or not, should be allowed.
Kyle, thanks for the call. And by stacking the deck, Sean, I think he means when lawmakers, whether it's Republicans controlling a state or Democrats, are drawing districts to determine who can vote for them.
Yeah, I mean, when the legislature or one party controls all of state government, as they did in 2011, there really is very little in state law. I guess nothing in state law at the federal level that prevents them from drawing a map that favors them. So, you know, it very much is a situation where they are permitted under the law to give themselves a very big political edge when it comes to redistricting. Now, when there's split control of state government, as there is right now, and you're getting into these issues like the Voting Rights Act, like what does it mean to be least changes? It's a little less straightforward, but yeah, redistricting does reward parties if they win elections at the right time, and those rewards can last for generations.
Sounds like a good subject for a podcast.
It does. You can listen to Mapped Out from WPR if you'd like to. WPR.org/mapped out.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Sean Johnson is with us, our Capital Bureau Chief here at WPR, co-creator of the Mapped Out, co-host of the Mapped Out podcast. Still time for your calls on this U.S. Supreme Court decision rejecting part of our election map here in Wisconsin that had been agreed to by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the part that applies to our state legislature. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Got a few comments there. Eric says, I have very little confidence that the U.S. mediocre court nor the Wisconsin mediocre court will deliver a constitutionally viable option. Andrew writes, we need fair, non-gerrymandered districts, no more representatives choosing their voters. Dan says, this is excellent. The Wise Court rejected gerrymandering in favor of freedom. Share your comment over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, Sean, we know the state Supreme Court's got to do something. You laid out some of the options. Does this potentially put things back on the table to go back into those federal court lawsuits at this point?
I think if the map had gone forward as is and had not been completely rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court, you probably could have seen a federal Voting Rights Act challenge move forward from somebody in federal court before that April 15th deadline. It's a little speculation at this point because right now you've got a state court trying to deal with what it means to comply with that federal law in the U.S. Constitution. But I think if Wisconsin politics has taught us anything, it's just that it's never over, right? And so even once the state Supreme Court resolves this with whatever it decides to do, whether it be basically preserving the governor's plan and showing their homework, just making changes to the Milwaukee districts, adopting the legislature's plan, whatever they do, there would still be potentially a window for a federal court challenge. And, you know, redistricting is the issue that just never stops.
Let's bring on one more caller. Robert is with us in Glendale. Robert, hi.
Hi. I was curious, following this case a little bit, that none of the Republican challengers even hinted at bringing up the independent state legislature doctrine, which has been floating around and has gotten some currency on the right and on the Supreme Court. And it seemed it would have been a natural place for them to go, but nobody went there.
Robert, thanks for the call. Yeah, the way that we do the maps here, it's just like any other state law, right? The legislature passes it, the governor signs it or vetoes it. The idea of just the state legislature going it alone hasn't come up as an option, as far as I know, Sean.
Yeah, but the dissenting justices in the state Supreme Court's decision definitely brought it up. So the state Supreme Court, when it sided with Evers, when it chose his maps earlier this month, that opinion was written by conservative swing justice Brian Hagedorn, who, by the way, is going to be the justice to watch this time around, too. And it was joined by the court's three liberal justices. The other conservatives dissented. And in one of those dissents by Justice Rebecca Bradley, you had this very vocal suggestion. I don't know if it was a total embrace, but saying, hey, maybe we need to revisit this 1964 unanimous state Supreme Court decision where the court said, no, the legislature can't do redistricting on its own. And she kind of floated the idea that maybe it could, that maybe the legislature could just do redistricting without the governor as a joint resolution. It wasn't an answer that the court was willing to hear in 1964. It's not something that people, Republicans, have pushed very hard this time around, but it's something that you had a few justices on this current state Supreme Court say they might be open to that when this was heard and decided in March, earlier March.
In our last few moments, Sean, what's the timeline? Has the state Supreme Court given any hint as to when they will tackle this?
Right. I've been trying to refresh the court's website here to see if they've offered any hints. At the moment that we are speaking, they have not, but you have the legislature, the governor, Republican members of Congress all sending these suggestions in here. So I have to think that the state Supreme Court is going to say soon what it wants to see as far as the timeline, and then they're going to have to make an expedited decision here.
Sean, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That was WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson with us today to talk about what comes next for Wisconsin's election district lines after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected state legislative maps from Governor Evers, approved by the state Supreme Court. In a separate order, the court upheld Evers' congressional district maps, also approved by the state Supreme Court. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, Congress could get rid of spring forward, fall back, but hold on, I guess makes the case we need to save standard time. Join that conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30 on the Ideas Network. There's been some March snow in different parts of the state over the last couple days. And as I was walking a few blocks from work today, I saw some of the biggest snowflakes I've ever seen. A lot of people were stopping and taking pictures. There may be a couple few inches, as the youth say, some of them. So, of course, I think what's the largest ever snowflake ever recorded? The Guinness Book of World Records has an answer that looks like it's probably wrong. They say a guy in Montana in January of 1887 reported seeing snowflakes bigger than milk pans. The largest, he said, was 15 inches. I poked around the online world of meteorology. The experts are skeptical on that one. There are lots of verified reports of snowflakes going from 3 to 4 inches, even up to 6. And a physicist who runs a website called snowcrystals.com says under the right conditions, snowflakes can come together to become as big as, quote, dinner plates, 10, 12 inch range. Of course, the tricky thing is preserving the evidence. Those giant flakes, they just melted away. Take my word for it. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, as the Senate wraps up its hearings for Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, Jen White gets your reactions to the judge and the politics. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, those Senate confirmation hearings are highlighting the partisan divide, but Democrats and Republicans have worked together to pass some significant legislation in recent weeks, including a congressional spending bill, aid for Ukraine, before that President Biden's infrastructure package. The bipartisan cooperation comes amid concerns over an increasing partisan divide in Congress and in the public. So what's really going on? Are politicians actually working together better than we think they might, or just finding some specific issues with common ground? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see signs that Republicans and Democrats can work together better sometimes than we might expect? If so, why is that? Do you want to see more bipartisan cooperation? Are there specific things that you think could bridge divides in Congress? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Ruth Block Rubin is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. She's the author of the book Building the Block, Intra-Party Organization in the U.S. Congress. Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Ruth, Congress is hopefully gridlocked because of a partisan divide, or, hey, look, Congress is working together on some bipartisan stuff. How do we sort it out to figure out if there's a trend one way or another?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I would say, you know, one thing that political scientists have noted is that at least since the 1970s, the bulk of what Congress actually produces is bipartisan. The problem is that for average citizens, we don't tend to hear about it. Some folks have even called this the work of the secret Congress, the idea being that Congress is secretly quite productive and in a bipartisan way. But those are not the issues that we hear most about as voters, in part because they're not that exciting, and parties themselves don't want to necessarily emphasize the ways in which they're similar and able to work together, but rather want to highlight their differences, because that makes it easier for us as voters to decide between the two.
Well, that makes me wonder about us in the media. Do we feed that by focusing on those issues where the politicians are highlighting the differences maybe too much?
I mean, I realize I'm in your house, but the short answer would be, I think so. I mean, I do think there's a reason politicians know that fights are more fun to cover and more interesting to viewers. And that's the kind of action that people want to see. Stories of harmony are not necessarily ones that are going to sell. And so there's some value. But it's also the case that I think we tend to think that parties are interested in cultivating reputations that are distinct from each other, make it easier for voters to tell the difference between the two parties. You certainly don't want voters to say, well, what's the difference? I could vote for anyone. It's not going to matter. And so there's a lot of incentives for political actors, whether they're presidents or members of Congress, to sort of highlight the differences between the two parties, even though on some lower salience issues, there's maybe more agreement.
I wonder about the impact of primaries here, because we have a lot of safe congressional seats, a lot of safe states where if I'm a member of Congress, I'm not so much worried about getting beat by the other party, with some exceptions, but I might be worried about a primary opponent coming up and showing pictures of me shaking hands with the leader of the other party as we agree on this infrastructure bill or whatever. Is there an incentive structure there that leads to some divisiveness?
I mean, I certainly think that's at play. I think pushing against that is the idea that, particularly for incumbent members of Congress, there's a desire to show that they've actually made a difference and are able to deliver to their constituents. And so to be able to claim credit for some of these lower salience wins can matter quite a bit. You want to show that you're effective as a representative or senator. And so, you know, if you're a smart legislative entrepreneur and you can sort of bring together a group of people that want to show that they can get things done, you actually can pass legislation. But both of these factors are at work at times. And so that I think can help to explain why sometimes it seems like Congress is intractable and at other times highly productive.
We're talking to Ruth Block Rubin from the University of Chicago Political Science Department, looking at partisan divides, but also partisan cooperation to pass specific bills in Congress. More of it than we might think. She says, call it at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Should we in the media pay more attention to bipartisan cooperation when it does happen? Do you want to see more of that cooperation? Do you think there's too much highlighting of the divides by members of Congress, by members of the media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's look at some of the specific items where we saw some cooperation. There's a recent spending bill passed, delaying a government shutdown and that sort of thing. Again, a lot of attention or some attention being paid to what we used to call earmarks showing up in that. Can you talk about that? It didn't end up being a crisis like some of these spending bills seem to be.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think it's important to recognize that at least historically, spending bills have often been pieces of legislation where it's the easiest to get bipartisan cooperation, because you can provide we call them today earmarks, but, you know, instead like projects that individual members want in their districts or states. And so it's easier to build a coalition that crosses party lines. In that way, I think we tend to think infrastructure has more bipartisan potential. But it's also the case that, you know, you have members who have longstanding commitments to certain issues. And if you can fold them together into an omnibus spending bill, that is a way to cross the kinds of partisan borders, which in other contexts, when it's simply about sort of a clear issue that both parties have staked out opposing positions on, it's a lot harder to win over individual members.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Iron River. Scott, hi.
Greetings to you both. My point is, when I try to find places that I can agree on or we can agree on with friends who are vastly different in political beliefs, one thing we can all agree on is we truly want people to go, whether it's local, state, or national, to go there and work together to get things done. And my point is always, this falls on the people, on the voters. And so I think it behooves us all to insist on our elected representatives to go and work together and not, and vote for that. And to, for candidates and our leaders to speak to the people about that. That no more partisan politics. It's up to us, the people.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. Is there a reward, Ruth, from voters, from candidates who can make the case that, yeah, I do work across party lines?
Well, it's not as much as one would like. I think political science studies have tended to find that, in fact, voters are more likely to punish what they see as flip-flopping. And so there are challenges for candidates who make promises that they then struggle to keep by trying to be more open-minded when they get to Congress. And so really, if voters want to see more bipartisanship, more voters need to reward that when it comes to the polls. And in some states and constituencies, they do. But it's certainly not a universally held value.
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Douglas joins us now in Cedar Grove. Douglas, hi.
Hi. My question is, she's talked about going back to the 70s, and I think that's way too long. What I want to know, has any major bill passed since the time of Gingrich? Because Gingrich's policy was anybody who cooperated was going to be targeted to be removed.
Douglas, thanks for the call. I think a key word there is major, Ruth. What kind of legislation, would you point toward with substantial bipartisan cooperation since the Newt Gingrich era?
Well, I mean, you can point to a variety of pieces of legislation. I would note that just in, you know, I think just in Congress today, there are pieces of legislation that have passed but would probably not qualify as major. That's certainly the problem. The issues that have a great deal of partisan politics swirling around them are, in fact, harder to pass. But that doesn't mean that you can't pass pieces of legislation that are perhaps lower salient. So, for example, recently, a piece of legislation that would make it easier for individuals who have suffered from sexual assault or sexual harassment not to be forced into arbitration is now going to Joe Biden to sign. So there are things that are very important to individual people that are passing, but on big ticket issues, it is harder. But the legislation that does pass is almost always bipartisan.
Thanks for the call, Douglas. We're talking about bipartisanship in Congress with University of Chicago political science professor Ruth Block Rubin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like seeing politicians work across party lines? Or if you support one party or the other, do you worry about too much compromise from the people on your side? Would you rather see your political leaders be firm on their agendas or be willing to compromise even on some things that might be important to you to get something else out of it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with University of Chicago political science professor Ruth Block Rubin about cooperation between Democrats and Republicans in Congress to pass legislation, bills big and small. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more bipartisan cooperation in Congress, more compromise between the parties? Do you think anybody's particularly responsible when things do break down, when partisanship does block things from getting done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Ruth, some bipartisanship on issues related to Ukraine lately. A lot of support for aid to Ukraine. A bill in the House on sanctions against Russia passed overwhelmingly, just 8 votes against it. Maybe hung up in the Senate now with at least one Republican objection. Is foreign policy an area where at least sometimes we see parties reach across the lines?
I think it's certainly the case that over the past several decades, there's been more consensus on foreign policy than domestic policy. But it's also the case that, in general, Congress takes action on issues where public opinion is clearly in favor of that, with some important exceptions like gun control. And if you look at public opinion on the conflict in Ukraine, it's quite clear that Americans are, a vast majority of Americans are supportive of Ukraine and interested in seeing aid and economic sanctions continue. And so in that way, it's kind of like a congressional no-brainer. And it's not clearly partisan, at least not yet.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Rob. I just need to say that there's no such thing as... Look, they go to Washington... It's a casino, and the casino pays off in the fact that it's pay to play, and they don't even think about the constituencies. All they care about is getting reelected, and they give us this notion, perhaps, that we think we have choice. No, Ralph Nader called it duopoly. The days were bipartisanship back in the 60s, 70s, when they had common...
I got you, Jim. I think a cynical view of politicians and members of Congress, Ruth, that I think a lot of people share.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's understandable. There's a lot to be frustrated about. I do think it's important to recognize that members of Congress do care about winning re-election, and they see the relationship with voters as part of that. But there are a lot of factors that go into it. And it's also worth noting that, you know, from an individual voter or constituent experience, it's gotten a lot harder for members of Congress to be responsive, in part because the number of constituents that members of Congress are expected to represent has actually increased dramatically. And so it's just gotten to be a tougher job. Now, I'm not here to defend their record, but I do think it's important to recognize that with limited staff and more people to serve, it's gotten to be a pretty tough job.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Ruth, over the years, sometimes on big issues, we see, you know, a gang of six or a group of 12 or whatever, where you get some Democrats, some Republicans on a big issue like immigration reform, for example, get together, try to hash something out that they can bring back to their own parties and try to build support for. Do those things work?
Yes, with a resounding yes. I think that kind of collaboration is incredibly important to lay the groundwork for bipartisan collaboration, particularly when it's not spearheaded by leaders. The sort of traditional model is leaders go fishing for votes across the aisle to insulate their own majorities, and that's all well and good. But to forge truly centrist policy, if you will, you often need this kind of cross-party collaboration that's engineered by the members themselves. And these organizations are really critical to doing that, in part because it's not well rewarded unless you make you get everything across the finish line. And so having organization to sort of structure that collaboration really matters, both in terms of drafting the legislation and lining up votes in favor of it.
Is there much of that going on right now? I'm speaking in the past tense about it. I'm not aware of big high profile efforts like that going on in this Congress.
Well, I would say you wouldn't expect them to be high profile. There are organizations like the Problem Solvers Caucus, which are bipartisan, and they have sort of become a forum for members to talk about issues that are probably not on the average political observer's radar, in part because those are the areas where you can make fruitful collaboration without worrying about electoral blowback. But on more prominent issues, I think that's where it has become quite difficult, in part because as majorities have gotten more narrow, the incentive for the minority party to sort of hold their line and not help those in control out has just created a really pernicious incentive to lead to failure.
We are talking about bipartisanship and when it can overcome partisan divides in Congress with Ruth Block Rubin, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago, author of the book Building the Block, Intraparty Organization in the U.S. Congress. Ruth, I wonder, is it easier to do, and I'm thinking here of like immigration reform, there are efforts to do everything at once that didn't seem to go, you know, security and changing paths to citizenship, that kind of thing. And there were arguments like, no, let's take it one piece at a time. Is there a better method on big high profile issues between everything at once versus a bit at a time?
Well, it does seem to be the case that the majority party, once it comes to power, tries to spend a lot of its time and energy passing an incredibly ambitious piece of legislation, in part to give a win to a president in power or to help members have something to brag about with voters. But winning on those issues is incredibly difficult. And so if you are a betting person, you might say that incremental change is a more productive path, although it may not be winning you lots of glory at home, which is part of the problem.
Let's go back to our callers now. Katie is with us in Spring Green. Katie, hello.
Hi, I just wanted to say I read about a bill that Tammy Baldwin sponsored in 2020 that was unanimously voted on by both sides in Congress and signed by Trump to create a three-digit hotline number for the suicide prevention line that's going into effect this summer. And if we had heard more about it, maybe some of these bills in other states wouldn't have as much support as they do. It was the first unanimously voted on bill that was explicitly to protect LGBTQ youth and veterans, and a really good thing that they're doing.
Katie, thanks for the call. And Ruth, this isn't necessarily the sort of thing that ends up being high profile if there isn't a big fight about it.
Exactly. And it creates a sort of odd paradox where in some ways we want to keep these issues quiet because it makes it easier for members of Congress to actually legislate on them. But then we as voters don't know about them in order to reward them for it. And that seems like a problem for the institution.
Katie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Ruth, I think sometimes we think, okay, there was a golden age where there really was significant cooperation and we've fallen away from that. Is there truth to that?
Well, nostalgia is a dangerous thing. there certainly was a period of time in the mid-century, the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, where there was a lot of cross-party collaboration. But in large part, that was because there were Democrats in the Democratic Party that were quite conservative, particularly on racial issues, and worked quite well with Republicans who had similar viewpoints. And they were quite liberal Republicans who worked with Democrats. And then over time, the parties sorted themselves out. And so now we have more partisanship. But you might say all the players are still there. They're just in the different parties as opposed to a cross party. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting that you got better politics or policy back then. What we might say is more importantly that the majority parties in those eras were much, much larger. And so that made it more possible to pass sweeping legislation that was part of the New Deal or the Fair Deal or Great Society that has made a big difference in people's lives. And the problem we face in Congress today is that, as we see in the Senate majority is very, very, very slim. And so it's very difficult. You have to have all of your own party members in agreement. And that is just about as hard to do as bipartisan work.
Time for one more quick call. Chuck is with us in Waupaca. Chuck, hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm just wondering about whether or not election reform, particularly in the primaries, might be a solution to this. I guess, the state of Maine, people can vote for, you know, sort of rank order. So it kind of takes away the real sharp partisanship in the primaries.
Chuck, thanks for the call. Ranked order, as some states do, like not a Republican versus Democrat, but an open field primary. Ruth, briefly, are those things that could change the partisan makeup?
I think it's an open question. There's certainly a possibility that would allow more moderate members who you might think would be more likely to work across the aisle come to the floor and win. But you might also worry that the incentives to distinguish your your party's candidates from others would lead to even more of this kind of messaging where the distinctions are being drawn as opposed to emphasizing the commonalities.
Thanks for that call. And Ruth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ruth Block Rubin is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago, author of the book Building the Block, Intra-Party Organization in the U.S. Congress. She was with us today looking at recent examples of bipartisanship in Congress on a variety of measures and what the future could hold. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, COVID numbers have been down nationwide lately. There is some concern, though, about the latest variant in the mix. We'll get the latest on COVID-19 plus vaccine news. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Sometimes you have time for slow food. Sometimes dinner needs to happen now. We'll get advice on making delicious dinners when we're on the clock. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we talk about the best movies of 2021 and the Oscars, which air live this Sunday with a film critic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.